Thanks. Nice to be here. Nothing like these meetings to get motivated to put some data together. I first want to acknowledge, I'm going to be talking about soil carbon, as illustrated by the title here. I wanted to first acknowledge my co-authors on this. From my own lab group at Cornell, Jeff B. Miller, Jonathan Comstock, and Sonam Sherpa. And then from Columbia University, Angela Kong and Amy Swan. This work is funded by a USDA NEPA project, which actually has a much broader scope, not only looking at carbon, but also nitrogen and greenhouse gas assessment, monitoring, and management in maize systems. On the soil carbon piece, in particular, what I want to talk to you about today is our effort to develop guidelines to evaluate, measure, model soil organic carbon change in these maize cropping systems and at minimum cost. We're now well into the fourth year of our project. We've collected over 2,000 cores at different parts of the U.S., as illustrated here. These different regions, besides the climate, soil differences, also represent fairly distinct maize cropping systems. In New York, maize production systems are usually associated with dairy. Tends to be rotation with alfalfa. Manure use, of course, in those sites. In Iowa, well, the corn soybean belt, I don't need to say much more about that. We've got that in there. And then in Nebraska, Colorado, a drier, arid environment, and irrigated sites. Collectively, we have both replicated long-term research experiments as part of this, as well as commercial farms that have had different treatments and management going on for anywhere from 10 to 40 years. I'm not going to go through this list of all the measurements and analyses, just to point out here that we went down to 75 centimeters at all sites, in some cases deeper and at different increments. The analyses we did, pretty standard procedures. The one thing I did want to bring up in terms of our methods is in terms that we have carbonates in some of our soil, so in order to come up with soil organic carbon, we first have to subtract out the soil inorganic carbon, and we've done that using the manometric pressure calcimeter type approach, but also we've found that mid-infrared spectroscopy has been a great proxy for measuring soil inorganic carbon. This is some data we've been working with the Lincoln Soil Survey Lab on this relationship between MIR spectroscopy and soil carbonates. They gave us a model based on their very large database that has really worked very well for us. In some ways, better than our lab procedure. We can end up with more errors with different people doing things in the lab than using the MIR as a proxy for this. And we developed our own model just based on our own database, and it really didn't change things much. A very robust approach. So I'm really pretty sold on MIR as a quick way to get at carbonates if you have access to MIR spectroscopy measurement system. So from here, I want to talk about these basic areas. Predicting soil organic carbon at lower depths from upper profile measurements to lower costs. Looking at the fixed depth versus equivalent soil mass approach to calculating soil organic carbon stocks. What is the real contribution of soil organic carbon at depth on whole profile soil organic carbon stocks and change? And then some special issues with rocky soils, which are very prevalent, particularly in the eastern U.S., New York, where we're working. First of all, in terms of this idea of predicting soil organic carbon at depth from the upper profile, this just shows, this is all based on soil organic carbon stock calculations. And you can see we have very high R values between measurements at specific depth increments or looking at the cumulative soil organic carbon stocks from 0 to 30 centimeters. Relatively high R values in terms of that relationship with the lower depths or total carbon stocks. And this is looking at a fairly big chunk of some of our data from New York and Iowa. We've now used that, with that encouragement, I guess, we're using this, applying this to looking at the feasibility of predicting lower depths on specific sites. This is looking at a few different ways of looking at the upper profile, different predictive X variables for predicting total carbon stocks. So on the y-axis here, we have the R-squared of simple linear regression models, different core depths. If you look up above 30 centimeters there, you can see we have R-squared values above 0.7. So by measuring simply the top 30 centimeters, we can capture about over 70% of the variability of the total soil organic carbon pool down to 75 centimeters. So that, and then when we take more sophisticated approaches, for example, advancing this on to looking at regression kriging, et cetera, we can get even better at predicting those lower depths, which is a great thing. The lower you go, much more labor, much more time, much more expense, and much more variability at depth. So the more we can use that upper profile to reduce the number of sites where we have to sample deep, the better. This is onto a different topic. An issue that we ran across quite quickly is the correlation, the inverse relationship between bulk density and soil organic carbon concentration. This creates a problem if you look at the formula at the bottom, which is used to calculate soil organic carbon stocks using the fixed depth approach. Those two things are multiplied times each other, and obviously they will tend to cancel each other out with this inverse relationship and mask treatment and management effects, and that's in fact what we've seen. Higher organic matter tends to reduce bulk density and creating that issue for us. So because of this, we've really moved towards equivalent soil mass in essentially all of our data, although we also calculated both ways. This is just another of a specific example from a particular site in upstate New York where we did some very intensive grid sampling. And there was, in addition to low manure and high manure long-term sections of the field, there was forest and pasture land use at this site. And the two top graphs are percent soil organic carbon on the left and bulk density on the right. You can kind of see that inverse relationship going. Forest, which has the highest carbon concentration, has the lowest bulk density. So then in the lower left graph, if you calculate soil organic carbon stocks based on the fixed depth approach, these two things tend to cancel each other out a bit, and we get very little resolution between these very dramatically different land uses. Whereas when we use the equivalent soil mass approach, the lower right graph, they segregate into at least three distinct, statistically distinct categories. This is summarizing all of our first 2 years of data for the different regions of the U.S., just showing the kind of pattern we're seeing through the profile in terms of soil organic carbon stocks. And this is also using a cubic spline function to smooth the data. And essentially, the panel on the left is for the Colorado Northeast, more arid region. There's much less carbon accumulation in the upper profile. We see a fairly similar pattern in Iowa and the Northeast, the New York area, in terms of substantially more carbon in the upper part of the profile. In all three regions, there is, of course, the lowest carbon deeper you go and a smaller fraction of the total carbon pool. This is looking at that. Here we see some examples of that pattern showing up for a New York site. This is one of our sites where it's a replicated long-term experiment, been going on for almost 40 years. And it's showing, we went to the exact same plots and sites in 1983 were sampled and in 2011, and looking at full inversion tillage versus no-till. In 1983, the experiment had already been going on for several years, and already we can see more degradation of soil organic carbon in the upper profile, as we might anticipate. Take that on to 2011, and the no-till is sort of more or less held its own, but more degradation of carbon in the upper profile. This is all sort of, we've seen this many times before in other studies. What I wanted to point out here is even after almost 40 years in 2011, we see very little carbon change at depth, which again questions, how often, how important is it to measure at depth? And of course, there are studies in literature and some places that we've measured, we do see some change at depth, but it takes a large number of replications and a lot more expense to get at that, and it still has relatively little impact on total carbon profiles when we have seen it, so that's something to take into account. This is looking at some specific data for the Plain States in Nebraska, Colorado, some maize, soybean, or maize, soy, wheat systems, minimum tillage versus no-till. Still here, we're also seeing, and this is also shown here in these graphs as the soil carbon change over an eight-year period where the exact same spot was measured 8 years apart. And what we can see in general, most of the action is in the upper part of the profile, although some evidence in the middle graph of some change at depth, which we still have not sorted through and figured out what's going on there, but the majority of change is happening in the upper profile in all of them. Interestingly, in the no-till in this hot arid site, at the very top part of the profile, where the crop residue just sits, perhaps due to the warm conditions there, dry conditions, it apparently turns over very quickly, and we don't see much accumulation in the top 10 centimeters, but down to 20 to 30. One thing we're looking at is many different, you know, developing guidelines for different sampling approaches for different types of soils. Rocky soils are something we're running up against a lot. I think when we look in the ag literature, there's a real scarcity of good information about rocky soils. There's more of that in the forestry literature. But we found out there's really a lot left to do on rocky soils. And we have a lot of questions about it and challenges with low-cost soil carbon assessment on those soils. We use a JMC slide power hammer. The Giddings, the lower right, you're all probably familiar with that coring method. The ground truth, as you might say, of course, is quantitative soil pits. For these rocky soils, we've invested in building a diamond-tipped rotary core that can actually cut through stone and rock. And we were hoping that might be a good solution for some of our rocky soils in terms of getting at good estimates of rock fragment percentages. This is an example from one site where we had relatively high rock fragment percent, about 24%. If you look at figure 2 there, the upper right graph, for the quantitative pit, our control, 24% rock fragments. But you can see even the rotary core dramatically really underestimated and significantly underestimated the rock fragment percent at that site. And the Giddings and the JMC even worse. And we're not amateurs at this anymore. My crew's been working with these cores for 4 years. I've been working at that, using them for almost that many decades. I think we know what we're doing, but my feeling is that it's very hard to capture all the rocks in these soils. Another issue with these is that while our cores can give us pretty good bulk density measurements at depth and mass estimates on regular soils, when you have high rock soils, they tend to underestimate bulk density. Fortuitously, that kind of works in our favor when you go to calculate soil organic carbon stocks. If you look at figure 4, that's soil organic carbon stocks calculated on the equivalent soil mass basis. And it sort of dampens out some of that big problem with picking up all the rock fragments. But that's sort of an artifact of actually getting inaccurate mass and bulk density measurements on these. So there's another issue with the rock fragments and rocky soils is what is the real carbon sequestration potential? Of course, you have a smaller fine earth volume. But for a given crop residue, you would expect then to have higher soil organic carbon concentrations in that smaller volume. We don't tend to see that. It doesn't seem to be going into the lower depths. Some of our preliminary analysis of our data. Is it turning over faster? Are the rocks somehow having an impact on that sort of thing? We do see a correlation between rock fragment percent and sand in the fine earth fragment, and that might have some impact on the staying power of carbon on rocky soils. But something that just needs a lot more research and investigation, I think. So finally, to summarize, as I showed that early slide, mid-infrared spectroscopy has worked really well for us for estimating soil inorganic carbon for our calculations. Because bulk density and soil organic carbon are inversely related, the equivalent soil mass approach to estimating soil organic carbon stocks is preferred over the fixed depth approach, particularly for this purpose. Given the required high sampling cost to quantify soil organic carbon change at depth, it may not be warranted, except under special circumstances, for example, working with places where you know crops have particularly deep rooting zones or whatever, and certainly thinking about measuring that and taking those kind of measurements over decadal time periods, because the magnitude of impact is small. Simple linear regression models have proved quite effective at predicting total profile soil organic carbon stocks from the upper 30 centimeters of soil, capturing as much as 70%. The variability, and when we go to regression kriging and other modeling approaches, we're seeing even a better prediction. Rocky soils are more variable, more expensive to do. Common coring methods routinely underestimate the percent rock fragments compared to the quantitative pit method. And really just a lot more work, I think, needs to be done on these rocky soils, which really comprise a large fraction of the agricultural land, but not really reflected in the ag literature. So I think a lot more research is needed there to look at soil organic carbon dynamics in on rocky soils. With that, I'll stop. Thank you.
We can can entertain a question.
Yes?
With your experience with the rocky soils, would then we need to take more samples to get a representative sample with the rocky soils because of the variability in the rock presence?
Yes, I mean, you know, just doing the regular power analysis thing, it leads towards more replication, and they're tough enough. It's, you know, it's already difficult, you know, it's already more expensive just because of the time consumption. And then, you know, I'm not sure, you know, how many cores it would take to really match up to the quantitative pit. You know, that really captures a very large area, a quantitative pit. And if you think about core diameters, and it's like you really, besides just the power analysis approach, I think one reason we're not getting it all with the cores is that. Of course, there can be some things, if you have very large stones that are beyond the diameter of your cores, that's a problem. But with the rotary core, we hope we would get around that, and we did. So rocky soils are just a real bear.
On that
point.
Yeah. Are you planning to look at the influence of organic carbon on the ability to store water? And we always say farmers that if you feed organic matter, you can extend longer, right?
Yeah, well, better water holding capacity and all that stuff.
No,
that's not really part of our study, but there have been a couple of people that have looked at both combining that, you know, water holding capacity and soil organic carbon analyses in the same studies. But our study, we're not really looking at that. It's another issue with rocky soils, of course, is that issue too. So, yeah, Jeff.
I think we'll be able to do it though, with modeling for mm-hmm. our brain agents and soil carbon, you have to
have available carbon. Yeah. Yeah, well established for those too. Yeah, Nancy?
If you want to actually just quantify, you know, just for a false understanding, how much carbon is there? How much carbon is in the rock?
Yeah. Well, we're not looking at that. So, and there, you know, there's papers out there where people have looked at that, and we've simply ignored that and viewed them as, you know, inert objects that are in the way of the, you know, yes, getting at the fine earth. But I think you're correct. I guess the one thing is, you know, we're looking at soil organic carbon change with management, and you know, we wouldn't expect, you know, the rock is not going to change its carbon concentration of the rock. So although the distribution and the et cetera, and the soil might change, so with management.
Well, soil management throughout.
Yeah, also pick rock pickers, right? Yeah, yeah. I hadn't thought about that. Yeah, loss of carbon from rock picking. Thank you.